Hey everybody, Jim and Aaron back with another Commission podcast. Josh Wilson, the madman from Sacksbaha, North Carolina, he is he hit us up for Screamers and then PCU. This might be his makeup commission from PCU.
Right.
The Wrath of Khan, 1982. Perhaps the finest Star Trek film ever made.
I'd never seen this movie going in.
I was going to say, I was like, what the fuck? No, okay.
Okay, I've seen it a whole lot.
All right. For my money, I think it's the best one.
Of the Star Trek movies?
Yeah.
Like old gen, new gen,
yeah.
All of it?
You want to make a case for Nemesis?
No, I actually really love First Contact.
Yeah, Nemesis,
yeah.
Fuck Nemesis. I'm at First Contact.
You know, First Contact is a little more nostalgic for me because I like the crew of the Next Generation,
right.
Better,
sure.
Frankly. Sorry to all you long-term, you know, old-school Star Trek fans. I also really, really love the original series crew.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong, but
I have almost equal affection for those two.
Yeah. So, you know, First Contact being the first of the Next Generation movies, if you don't count the Horrible Generations film.
Yeah, if you just conveniently rewrite history.
Well, the first of the purely,
okay.
How about that?
Right.
First with no taint from the original series.
No Shatner taint.
Yep. Although that was a good bridge. But yeah, I think this is easily the finest of the...
It's a good bridge. That bridge killed Captain Kirk. I think it was
series.
A bad bridge.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
The bridge fell and he...
He always writes himself back in with the books, like The Return.
Sure.
I mean, come on. And then I think he did it again with a sequel to The Return.
Yeah. Do you think he actually wrote any of those books? Because when I was a kid, I read his... I can't even remember what the futuristic detective shit that he wrote.
Yeah, the tech series, the Tech Wars and Tech.
Is that what it is? Yeah,
I have one of those.
I feel like that shit's got to be ghostwritten. I don't see Shatner sitting down with the attention span to write a novel.
Right.
Anyway, I think it's the best. My personal favorite, Star Trek IV.
Really?
But
okay.
I think that that is, you have to be a pretty big fan of Star Trek. Otherwise, it's just a fucking farce.
Okay, so you're saying, you know, it's not the best Star
Trek. It's not
Trek
the best,
IV, but
it's,
it is your
it's
favorite.
Certainly my favorite. The one that consistently has a smile on my face. And it's
right.
Just really funny. Like, mm-hmm. I'll never get tired of, like, I guess, like Buzz Lightyear style deluded Spock not understanding profanity and then clumsily trying to use it and
uh-huh.
Shatner's reaction the same and, you know, Scotty trying to talk into a mouse. That stuff's solid gold, man. And I'm just in the same way that I kind of half, you know, half seriously believe that Rocky ended the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
I more seriously believe that the Star Trek IV saved the whales.
Okay.
Like, you know. I'm not saying the whales are fine. I actually don't know, but I definitely know they're better shape than they were in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So should we should talk about we should give Josh his due here. He says Anubis 21 back to feed my slightly worrying obsession with commissioning podcasts. I had a difficult decision to make as I was tempted to have you talk about aliens, but then I thought about my introduction to science fiction movies, and it all begins with Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. Even more so than The Next Generation, which was prevalent during my formative years from the time I was 7 to 14 years old, Wrath of Khan has always been the shining light of Star Trek, the Star Trek universe, and the best movie in the series by a long shot. It began the trend of kick-ass, better-quality, even-numbered Star Trek movies and features the best villain to date. Sorry, General Chang, Borg Queen, Dr. Sauron, Voyager, or V'ger, Cybok,
yeah.
Tom Hardy, Christopher Lloyd, and those stretched-faced assholes from Insurrection. One thing, though, do you feel that Chekhov's remix hurts the film, or is that being me too much of a Trekkie and no one gives a shit?
Wait, Chekhov's remix?
Yeah.
What does he mean with Chekhov's remix?
I don't really know, but I'm guessing the fact that, this is the one where I don't know. I might need to follow up on that. We might need to do a drop, because I'm guessing he means that Chekhov is not actually part of the crew. He's a secondary part. And he's kind of a minor villain and
okay.
That kind
yeah.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys agree that Wrath of Khan is the pinnacle of Star Trek universe? Anyway, Aaron, I know you consider yourself a Star Trek expert, so be prepared to catch good-natured hell in the forums from me if you screw that up, because I am as well. Well, I don't know about that, because I don't know that I can bring some deep lore. I read some behind the scenes about this. This is written and directed by Nicholas Meyer, who was brought in by Bennett to kind of save the franchise, and he wrote this script in 12 days and he consciously decided that the big problem in Star Trek the movie, correctly, I think he diagnosed, was an overly reverential tone. Like, just too much, like, standing in slack-jawed awe of the Enterprise, too much shots of weird energy clouds, and just too much Gene Roddenberry crawling up his own ass. And he said, I want to bring some humor. I want to bring it back to, like, some kind of military tradition. And he, you see a lot of, like, overly naval touches. Like, at one point, the captain's piped onto the bridge. There's, like, a ship's bell keeping time. You know, I really noticed when I was, you know, putting my critical hat on how much this movie, especially the last act, owes to, like, submarine movies. And that kind of, those touches have really influenced the movies. Like, they kept that consistent look and feel as far as the military uniforms and that kind of style up through Star Trek VI. And even, you know, a lot of the ship-to-ship combat in the later series, I think, owes a lot to its, of its heritage to the to what Nicholas Meyer did. He also wrote and directed Star Trek VI and wrote Star Trek IV. The other interesting thing is that this is the movie that kind of made James Horner's career. He went on to not just, you know, I'm just going to mention the stuff he won Academy Awards for: Field of Dreams, Apollo 13, Braveheart, Titanic, Beautiful Mind, Avatar, Aliens. And then he tragically died in a plane wreck, I think, last year. So, but yeah, he obviously had a huge storied career, and it arguably began in Star Trek II. Also, other thing about Nicholas Meyer, he's one of the head writers for Star Trek Discovery.
Interesting. Okay.
I had kind of been slowly over the last year dialing my expectations down for that series, but damn it, you know, that guy knows how to write a Star Trek.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it makes me necessarily more excited for that show. I still, like, you know, after Enterprise and Voyager, which both of which I didn't care for, Enterprise, which I really didn't like, I don't know how excited I am for
the fans saying, if you made it to season 2 and 3, Enterprise got real good. But
no, I bet it did.
The big problem I have, it's CBS, and also it's CBS's online service. I just don't know how much love it's going to get. Anyway, that has neither here nor there to do with Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So let's talk about this. I think you can't, you have to begin the conversation about Star Trek II with the villain, because I think Josh is dead on, and this is, if you want to give an argument to, like, the Borg Queen, maybe she's the best villain if you're sympathetic to that, but I think I think the Khan is heads and shoulders of the best Star Trek villain in a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I started thinking, like, man, they kind of lucked out that they cast Ricardo Montalban in this thing and he was able to crush it, because he was just this one-off guy on a Star Trek series, and he did Fantasy Island, which I understand is highly regarded. But imagine, like, you know, if they'd cast some goofball, like
Shatner, let's say.
Yeah. If Shatner, well, of course, I don't know. Like, that's the thing about
he's good. He's fine.
That's the thing about Khan, is he can go toe to toe with Kirk on that Shatnerian scale.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's not doing subtle things when his face is dripping with rubber cement at the end and covered in blood, and he's talking about, with my last breath, I spit at thee. I don't know.
Yeah, no, he's a fantastic villain. I think, you know, the personal nature of this really services the movie well. Like, the grudge that he's got with Kirk.
Yeah.
And I think it was smart to bring him back for that.
And you can even, like, you know, is the grudge deserved? Because, you know, Kirk left him there on a very nice planet in lieu of executing him or taking him to space prison, and left one of his crew members that he'd fallen in love with. Pretty good deal. Like, is it Kirk's fault that the planet, one of the planets exploded and fucked up the orbital mechanics?
No. He's just angry that Kirk never stopped by. Never stopped by to say hi.
I mean, fair point. Chekhov and his captain, what was the captain's name?
I don't know.
The Captain Eel Ear. They're surveying the Ceta Alpha system, and they don't just even do a long-range scan of Khan. Like, wouldn't you want to keep an eye out on a criminal mastermind like that? What if Khan? Well, no, I mean, just Starfleet. Like, I don't think Kirk did that in secret, did he?
I don't know.
Maybe it did. Maybe
I don't remember the original.
I wonder episode. if that's a plot point that Kirk kept this off the books so Starfleet wouldn't harass
but
him.
But at the very least, Chekhov should know, right?
Yeah, like just check. You know, it's like if you moor, you know, Lex Luthor on an abandoned planet. Uh-huh. How do you know he hasn't cobbled together warp drive and he's not right. breeding another race of super soldiers? He's going to take over the Federation again.
Yeah, especially when he's got the superior intellect.
Yeah, although not much of that. Not much of that
we can talk about that eventually, but sure.
The thing is, he looks the part. He looks like he's like set his own little Mad Max colony down there. I mean, mm-hmm. now that I'm watching with adult eyes, it's like it's kind of impressive that they've managed to survive. That desert planet looks like it's just hell. There's nothing living or growing there other than those fucking eels, and yet they've got 50, 60 strong, genetically modified super soldiers just chilling out.
Yeah, are they, I guess they would also inherit his genes, so they would be genetically modified, or at least some of them would be, depending on the dominant genes that...
Well, see, I always thought that these were his children.
How they express.
But I think the movie makes it explicit that these are actually fellow members of military organization. Because he said some of these men have sworn their lives to me over 200 years ago.
Right, right.
Now one or two of them, like some of them look pretty young. Maybe they're his kids.
And I think, I want to say like the one who dies on the bridge is probably his son or something.
Yeah.
Because like he's like, I will avenge you.
Yeah. Seems like he was more than a little attached to him over like no one else. Like there's shit. All of his dudes died and nobody else gets to tearful.
Go to each one. I will avenge you. Yeah. And I will avenge you.
That's why he lost.
That's true. He didn't.
That's why he set a 999 second timer on the Genesis. So he had to do a loop around the ship and say, "You're being avenged. Just want you to know, you too. Got you, buddy."
Yep. And then get back to the bridge so he can watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's hobbled, like he's got his arm pinned to his chest, and
doesn't seem like he can
shot
really
to
walk.
Hell.
Yeah.
I mean, he can barely fit that weird metallic cylindrical Rubik's cube going. Like, yeah, it was a real struggle for him.
Yeah. What's up with that system?
I have no idea.
So first of all, it's a system that's connected to the Genesis device that interfaces with it.
Yeah, it's wired
into Starships have those? Like, I suppose the research station would have to communicate with it somehow.
Yeah.
So maybe they just use the standard Starfleet tech
right. To
do so.
Yeah. And I buy that. That's another thing. Like, I buy that Khan and his people are smart enough to figure out how to use a starship given 2 or 3 days of travel time. Like, and they're not experts. Like, Kirk pretty handily fights them in a fair fight, which makes sense because maybe Khan is a super genius, but also, you know, Kirk's got 20-plus years of actual Starfleet experience. So,
right. I think the other thing about that mechanism, though, is it's essentially like the Windows dialogue pop-up that asks you, are you sure? Like, as you twist each ring, it just wants to make sure you have to think about what you're doing.
Are you sure you want to delete these files? Are you really sure? Type, delete, you know?
Right. Are you sure you want to create life on this planet?
Right.
Really? Are you sure? And it asks 5 times, and then it's like, okay.
Life on this planet. Mm-hmm. Genesis is damn near magic. It's already kind of baseline magic. Like, I don't understand what kind of fucking Genesis wave can actually rewrite a planet's surface and make life where there wasn't there, or take pre-existing life and reconstruct it. But for damn sure, I don't expect a torpedo designed to work on a planet to explode in the middle of a fucking nebula and assemble a whole planet.
Yeah.
Like, how does that work?
You really have to ignore that at the end.
Yeah.
Because I don't know.
I mean, I guess they're in a nebula, which is there's enough raw materials there that it can collapse into.
I feel like it's a metaphor, right? Like, it's more about metaphor than it is about actual science. It's just trying to say, look, there are kind of prototypical planet stuff here.
Yeah.
We can use this Genesis device to create life from it. You know, just as they were doing on the lifeless planets, except taken to the extreme.
I wish I had seen this like in theaters as a kid, because I didn't get really into Star Trek until I was 12 or 13. Whenever Star Trek Next Generation came out, then I kind of backed into. And I remember how excited I was when I was like, "Oh, I'm gonna watch the fucking Star Trek the motion picture."
Yeah.
And then like, what the fuck is this?
It's pretty bad.
I didn't know that you had, you know, it would be many years later till I figured out that you have to be drunk and or high to enjoy Star Trek the motion picture. Because what I'm really curious is the opening with the Kobayashi Maru simulation.
Yeah.
Did that land? Did people, were people actually like, holy shit, people, what the hell? There goes Chekhov. There goes Sulu. There, uh-huh. Well, not Chekhov.
Yeah.
He was
Sulu
off.
Is dead. Spock is Uhura dead. Uhura
bites
beginning.
At Spock. Like,
which is a nice little bookend.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was wondering that too. Like, this is a seriously shitty way to start out a Star Trek movie if you don't know that's coming.
But I wonder if anyone bought that. Or if that's just like, oh, I don't know how. I mean, I don't know how they're going to undo this, but they're going to definitely undo
this.
How
could you if you saw like a preview for it, right?
Yeah.
Because you would have to know, okay, they're in it more than 30 seconds.
Yeah, and I feel like, and this might be unfair, but I feel like that audiences are getting more sophisticated all the time. And every time you go back like 30 years, things look a little bit shakier. Like even like, we were talking about this. The degree of difficulty for making a science fiction film is so much higher. Like, you can't get, unless you want to go like Star Wars, like just space fantasy, you can't get away with a line like, and then the planet exploded and it spirals. Like, wait, time out. How the fuck did a planet explode? Like, I can see a sun exploding, but what is that? Is a planet made out of unstable uranium? Like, what the fuck would cause a planet to explode?
Volcanoes.
Klingons blow up their home planet because they're mining and doing a whole bunch of dilithium antimatter bullshit. Fine, I can, but an uninhabited planet just fucking exploding? What the hell?
Yeah.
But you could do that. You could get away with that, and nobody bats an eye.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I tend to ignore that stuff in these movies, too, because, you like you said, you know, you can't judge modern movies by the same standards.
Right.
Or old movies by the same standards you would modern movies.
Right. Even, like, you know, it seems like if one criticism I have for Star Trek is it seems like in an effort to paste over those problems, starting in the Next Generation era in particular, they started really leaning into that Trekno babble.
Yeah.
Where they wouldn't say that the planet exploded. They would say that some kind of graviton wave from a nearby inverted nebula hit it and shook it apart.
Broke
you know.
It to pieces.
Yeah. It wouldn't just be the fucking planet
or
exploded.
Or destabilized its positron matrix.
Yeah.
And it imploded on itself.
Exactly. And I don't know that that's an improvement. It's essentially just like, hey, these are a lot of sciencey words, and I got a honest to God cyborg saying them, so he knows what he's talking about. Trust him. He's positronic.
Let me ask you. So we talked briefly about the intro, the Kobayashi Maru. Let's go back. I do want to talk more about the Kobayashi Maru, but let's go back to the very beginning, the intro, the credits sequence. I have to say, it leaves a little bit to be desired. But I think there's something like timeless and classic about just a star field with text on it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, movies don't really do that. They want to spice up the intro a little bit, or they do a late title card or something now. Because we've seen 1,000 credit sequences, and a lot of them are like this. They're just text telling you all the actors who you're about to see. How do you feel about the intro to this? Because I almost feel like it sets an all right tone for this movie.
No, I enjoyed it. And like, I feel like we're a little bit jaded with Starfields ever since like Windows came out with the, but that was kind of for its day really cool. In fact, there
it's
was
just white dots, but I think it looks cool,
but I don't think that was necessarily easy to do back then. Yeah. And like, I think there's some things like the Genesis, like when they do the simulation and the Genesis effect, like that shit was like state of the art back in the day. You know, there's
just
some
like
things
these
that
geodesic lattices and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like I said, it's primitive by today's standards. It's like primitive by like mid-90s video game cutscene standards. But back in the day, it looked like $1 million and like the retinal scan and all that stuff. I mean, that's the thing about Star Trek. It's hilariously outdated when you look at like, you know, we were talking about when Chekhov and his Captain Eel Ear were talking to Kirk's side piece and her son, like the image was all like losing its horizontal stability and shaking and warbling, and it's obviously this big fat CRT tube. And I'm like, who knew that, you know, 20 years after this movie had made, we'd vastly surpass their, you know, monitor technology. But what are you gonna do?
Yeah, how do you predict that stuff?
That's one of the things I think is so amazing about like the Rogue One, how they were able to essentially use the same graphics but some and workstations and everything, but clean them up enough to make them look like they're brand new again. Like if you watch A New Hope, like that shit's old, like you can see like the pixels and stuff. They took that same design and just like gave it a high definition, and like it's like the, you know, A New Hope Death Star Gunner remastered or whatever.
Huh. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's just it's cleaned up and not old as shit looking.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't. I guess we should briefly talk about the plot. We kind of already did.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
Because I just want to make random Star Trek observations is kind of what I want to do the rest of the
Me
podcast.
Too. Like, I have a lot of, like, little observations I want to do. But sure, if you want to talk about the movie plot, like, narrative-wise and thematically, I think we can go there. Because there's a lot of, you know, Tale of Two Cities in there.
It's also a tale of, like, you know, this is Captain Kirk and the crew of the Enterprise no longer in their prime. You know, right. Kirk has accepted an admiral's position, which, you know, is a promotion, but it means he's not going to be out on the front lines anymore.
Yeah, and he's essentially dead.
He needs reading glaces because he's allergic to Retin-A or whatever the
right.
the magic. Rockinox. Rock.
Sounds right.
So McCoy gives him a pair of old reading glasses.
Yeah, which I'm shocked they don't have some kind of laser surgery.
Right, like they didn't see that coming.
Fix his fucking eyes.
Or contact lenses.
I guess it's a pill.
Yeah.
It's a pill you take.
Yeah.
Everything was a pill back then. Meals are going to be pills.
I mean, McCoy can give an old woman in Star Trek IV a pill that regrows her kidneys. He can't just, like, give... I guess he's allergic to the...
He's allergic.
The retina-growing pill.
It sucks.
There's the theme of all these people are getting old and things are coming to an end.
Yeah.
And, like, Spock's death. That's another thing I want to talk about. Like, I think that Kirk's... That William Shatner's performance during the funeral of Spock might be peak Shatner. Like, that was incredibly restrained for him. And it actually worked as a genuine human moment. Like, I bought it that this guy who is in command of the starship and his admiral is just quietly losing his shit about losing his best friend. And, you know, there's always also the element that, like, I appreciate about the Master and Commander series is, like, that these were good friends that were very, very different people. And they might not even have fully understood them to the very depths of their being because, you know, how do you understand someone as inscrutable as Spock? And how can Spock understand someone as passionately human as Kirk?
Mm-hmm.
But when he's given him his eulogy, like, that's a real genuine moment.
Yeah.
And then Scotty fires up the bagpipes and watch out.
Yeah, I wondered in that scene, like, where they're shooting Spock out of the torpedo tube, how did they decide who gets to be in that room? Because it's a very small room.
Right.
And, like...
And you got to think that Spock dying has got to be, like... I mean, I don't even know what the equivalent would be. It would be, like, I don't know, Norman Schwarzkopf back dying in the, like, the mid-2000s or something. Like, okay, everybody... Yeah. He was the general in command of Desert Storm.
Oh, okay.
Or like Colin Powell or something. Like, he would be a big state funeral.
Yeah. You'd think a bunch of people from the ship. I mean, the crew's huge.
Right.
The crew's more than just the 40 or so people you see in there.
Plus, this, and if you just want, I was thinking, like, I'm wondering if the Federation gave him shit for not bringing, you know, Vulcan's favorite son back to the Kessel so they could have his big state. Like,
maybe
really?
He shot him at Vulcan. Maybe he shot him at the planet.
And missed and hit the Genesis. Like, there wasn't a planet there a minute ago.
Oh, that's right. They created the planet in front of the path where they shot Spock.
Right. But you're right, because not only that, not only is he incredibly popular, but to this crew, Spock was also their teacher.
Okay, yeah. They,
like, every one of the trainees, he was, like, in charge of that whatever military unit.
Right.
So they would, like, you'd think that everybody would crowd in that torpedo tube and want to send him off.
I would think so. But it seemed rather spacious in there, or rather sparse.
It's also weird how many highly decorated Starfleet officers would be just lounging around in this teaching environment.
Yeah, what?
Like, Chekov's
the
only
Sulu
guy that was
there?
Able to escape the gravity of Jim Kirk.
I guess so. I mean, Spock was, like, the captain of the Enterprise, right?
Uh-huh.
So Spock was there just training his new cadets, which makes sense. And I guess, you know, Sulu is still assigned there. Uhura is still assigned there on the Enterprise, so they're along for the ride.
I mean, I don't know. Like, speaking of the Master and Commander series, that was always a thing that the, you know, Jack Aubrey, whenever he went ship to ship, he had a little bit of latitude to bring, like, certain officers and his personal boat crew, and like he could take them from commission to commission. So maybe since he's leaning in his naval history, you're just supposed to assume that Kirk would have a little bit of latitude. You know, Spock's in command, Kirk's an admiral, and Kirk's keeping a few of his followers as his like personal entourage.
That's at like, do they not have free will? Are they not, like, do they not want to be captains? Like, does Sulu not want to helm a real starship?
Well, I imagine being, attaché to a decorated admiral would be, like, that's probably a pretty quick way to get a captain's, you know, be a captain. And also eventually becomes a captain in Star Trek VI. He's commanding the Excelsior, I believe.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, maybe.
But harder and harder to explain why. Like, I know that some good bits of, like, Star Trek 3 and 6 revolve around, like, getting the crew back together from wherever they're at. Because, and like, even the later Next Generation, it's like, okay, fucking Riker, is he ever going to be a captain or what? You know?
I think he does eventually turn into a captain.
Yeah, yeah. And Worf is on the how do you get Worf back from Deep Space Nine? Oh, well, he's on the Defiant for this big battle of the Borg. Like, you have to, because these people on the flagship of the Federation, you would think that all that bridge crew would be fast tracked to promotions of doing whatever the hell they want to do.
Right, the most famous ship in the fleet.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know.
But kind of going back to, you know, Spock's death and stuff, there's a lot of thematic resurrection here. Like, Kirk, over the course of this movie, is resurrected from his state of admiralty to the captain's seat, where he thrives, where he feels like a kid again. There's Khan, who's essentially resurrected from this isolation he's had on this planet. There's obviously the Genesis device, which brings life from lifelessness. And Spock, I think it's heavily alluded, as you said when we watched this movie, that Spock is going to be back. I mean, even if you haven't seen number 3, I think there's a lot of indication at the end of this movie that Spock is not gone forever.
Almost too much. Like, I was discussing, like, it's not quite like dirt hovering off of the coffin of Superman, but gee whiz. You've got him mind-melding with McCoy and saying, remember, and then you've got, you know, him being shot to the Genesis planet, which we know is rewriting the Life's Matrix and restoring things, and then they give you that shot of, like, Spock's coffin at the end, and I was making a joke, it's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if, like, Leonard Nimoy's fist, like, punches through it? So I did a little bit of research, and I guess that initial audiences were so outraged that they killed Spock, and also Leonard Nimoy made it a condition of being on this movie that you write me out. I never want to put these fucking ears on again.
Really? And then he went on to do 4 more.
Well, he had so much fun doing this that he actually said, you know what, I actually want to leave it out so I can come back. And I think he ended up directing Star Trek 4, so they kept on like offering these carrots to keep these guys engaged and involved.
Yeah.
But audiences went apeshit.
For Shatner, it was like, okay, we'll give you the size 3 girdle this time. Size 4, we know it made you look a little chubby. Size 3, we'll do it, we promise.
Right. Yeah. Then we'll make sure your toupee budget is covered. But where was I going? Oh, the audience was just flipping out how dark and depressing, I think that you need a little bit of dark and depression in some of these trilogies. Like, people need to die and things need to change or else there's eventually no stakes. Mm-hmm. And they went back and added specifically I know for a fact they added the coffin scene at the end of the movie. And they shot that in a single day in, like, some overgrown park in the Golden Gate Bridge Park. They pumped a shit ton of fog in it.
Oh, the shot of him on the planet?
Yeah.
In the coffin?
In the coffin. And they added a couple other touches to make it, to give it a little bit more certainty. But I was asking, like, if I'm a audience member, I guess I'm saying, oh yeah, he's gonna be back next movie. And of course,
he sort of is. Yeah, I mean, it's the search for Spock, right? And by the end of it, they have certainly found him.
But that's, like, for most of the movie, he's like some little boy / teenage. Like, so, like, Leonard Nimoy is in a shocking few scenes of Star Trek. Oh, they also added that's the other thing. They added Leonard Nimoy's voiceover doing the, you know, to kind of give you another little bit of a shot in the arm for the Spock mourners.
Yeah, it's actually like, so I was reading, obviously the Tale of Two Cities is prominent in this movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Kirk gets that as a birthday gift from Spock at the very beginning. He quotes the beginning line at the beginning of this movie. He quotes the end of the line or the end of the book. Yeah. At the end of the movie, and there's a lot of stuff thematically that lines up with it. It really feels like this is a combination of both A Tale of Two Cities and Moby Dick, which is also seen in the movie. Mm-hmm. It's in Khan's cargo container on SETI Alpha 5.
Kind of amusing to William Shatner as his white whale.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the girdle budget was small. On this
right,
one.
Right.
You know?
I thought, here's the thing. I thought this is still pretty close to peak Shatner. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I remember thinking that he looked pretty old as a kid, especially compared to, like, you know, when I was fresh off watching the old series on reruns. Mm-hmm. But you compare him to, like, you know, Shatner in Boston Legal, or even Shatner in Star Trek VI or Generations, and, like, nah, he's still plausibly playing a kind of swashbuckling captain here.
I think so. Yeah, he's borderline, but
I mean, for sure,
works.
He needs the, you know, like, his appetites and his hair pieces are legendary. Like, this is his he was already in a girdle and a hair piece season 3 of Star Trek the old series.
Right.
So I don't think a couple years of TJ Hooker helped that situation any.
Probably not. But I don't know. I think it's interesting because one of the themes in Tale of Two Cities, and I've not read the book. I did a lot of research and reading on it, about the book on Wikipedia. And it was talking about, you know, the sacrifice at the end of that book that this specific character makes. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, the whole thing's about the French Revolution and the sort of horrible lead up to the revolution and the way that the people were treated.
I can't remember his name, but he actually takes the place of the other character,
right,
and goes to the guillotine.
Yeah,
I had to read that
and
in
makes
junior
that
high.
Sort of noble sacrifice, yeah, in the same way that Spock does in
yes.
this movie.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of it is about kind of, you know, the violence and the horrible things that have to happen in something like a revolution,
mm-hmm,
for something better to come of it, right? For the old ways to be left behind and something
right.
new to come out and be better. And I think that's one of the things that Kirk is learning along the way, is sort of like the consequences of his actions, mm-hmm, actually matter. Like, there are a lot of consequences for Kirk in this.
Yeah, you go around fucking space chicks all the time,
right.
You're going to get a space baby that you don't even know about.
Yeah, you don't know about your space baby. You've got Khan, who is a guy that you exiled years ago, come back
never
to
thought
haunt you.
Never thought about him again. You know?
You've got the sacrifice that Spock has to make because of that guy,
mm-hmm,
and you also have the idea that Kirk doesn't follow regulations at the beginning of this, right?
Right,
and which is what leads to kind of all the trouble here.
Yeah, if he had fucking raised his shields
right.
when Kirstie Alley started quoting him a chapter and verse, none of this would have ever happened.
Right,
because surely the Reliant is not as strong as the Enterprise.
I can't imagine,
because it's like a research vessel.
Yeah.
I've always liked that class of starship. I always thought that was a really cool looking starship. Mm-hmm. But I'm just like, you
the
know, the Enterprise is the
on
flat.
The top.
Huh?
With the spoiler on top.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And the twin nacelle slung low. It's a little bit more like, you know, conventional warship. Maybe it is a tougher ship, but I always thought the Enterprise was always the flagship and one of the stronger ships.
Mm-hmm.
There's always, like, I remember reading some of the novels, there was, like, you know, battle cruiser class that they would bring out in times of war, but, like, you know, in times of peace, that Enterprise was always top dog. So if he fucking raises shields and charges phasers, and why wouldn't you? Like, that's not a hostile. You're approaching a Federation ship, and for whatever reason, it's not communicating. Raise your shield. You don't have to blast them out of the sky.
Right. Right.
Just
at
fucking
least
raise your
yourself.
Shields, man.
Yeah, I don't know why Kirk doesn't do it, but he doesn't. And, you know, there are consequences to pay. One of them being Spock has to make this sacrifice.
Right.
And I think Kirk learns a lot about, you know, his own behavior and how it affects both himself and other people. And by the end of this, he is more aware of it, at least.
There's a lot of, because I've read the novelizations for all these books, these movies back in the day, and there was a lot of little details that never made it. I don't know if it made it into the screenplay, and just they got cut. I noticed there's a director's edition that we decided not to watch because it's a little bit longer, and I'm like, eh, you know, let's watch the classic. But there's a lot of really cool touches about the relationship between Spock and Saavik, that she's actually a half-Romulan that I get that, you know, had a really rough upbringing. I think her mother was a Vulcan that was a slave that got abducted by the Romulans, and so she's like the product of this, like, you know, slave rape deal, and that she's also got a lot of rough edges, and she's all, you know, Romulans are not as logical and their culture hasn't beat all the emotions. So she's also got, like, you know, still a savage Romulan heart beating in her.
It's the half Vulcan, half human. and the half Vulcan, half Romulan.
Yeah.
Going toe-to-toe with who's the least emotionless.
Right. But there's a lot of, like, where they kind of suggest that. Like, I liked in the beginning where she's fully grasping how fucked she is with this Kobayashi Maru, and she's like, damn, you know, like, under her breath. Like, they do a lot of this, like, alluding to that detail, but it's not actually in it. And I also think, and this is what I'm less sure about, but I also think that Scotty, his number one engineering student, was like a nephew of his.
Which explains
why he was particularly shattered when he died. And, you know, he would, like, because we thought it was is almost borderline funny that you would drag this guy's corpse all the way to the bridge to, like, lay at Kirk's feet.
Right.
Like, look what you did, you know, look what you did.
I think it's also, knowing that, it's also a little ridiculous that Kirk doesn't take that death more seriously. It takes the death of Spock, his best friend, to actually shake him up and say, your actions have consequences, man.
Yeah.
Scotty's nephew dies, no big deal.
Yeah.
No big deal.
I don't know. Like,
your entire crew is getting ripped to shreds by falling debris from the roof of the bridge.
I think that's understandable. You grieve as a commander just in general. But, like, you know, if we had a coworker in Bald Move and their nephew died, I'd be sad for them. But then, like, if you died, I'd be a whole other level of sad. So.
But, like, I guess this is a lesson he should have learned over and over and over again.
Well, that's the other thing is, I mean, I did see a lot of Star Trek, and I see a lot of crew members die, but none of his, I guess, friends died. But I did think it was incredible that this military officer at one point says, I've never experienced a loss like this.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm not even sure that's canon if you take in all of, like, the novels and stuff. Like, you've really never lost a close friend?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Spock was his best friend.
Like, put all the phasers and photon torpedoes to a side.
Right.
You're exploring space. Mm-hmm. There could be some kind of all-powerful fucking weird-ass face that comes out of a nebula and decides to eat half your crew because it wants to see how you taste. Not to mention the black holes and the gamma bursts and everything. Then you got all hostile assholes trying to kill you. Like, really? You've never lost a close personal friend?
I guess not. Yeah. I mean, the captain maybe, you know, doesn't get close to people the way that some others might.
Yeah.
It's really him and the bridge crew, and that's kind of it, the officers there.
But there are a lot of good moments. Like,
there are.
The cell, like, you know, him, like McCoy and him talking about getting old and how he needs to go back to his ship, and, like, then him and Spock having an almost identical conversation. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, like, Star Trek, especially the classic series, is all about the relationship between those three men. You know, the others were like, it, you know, he never was that close to, like, Uhura or, you know, Sulu or Chekhov or even Scotty.
Right.
So
it's always been him and Spock.
Yeah. Like, I think it would almost be silly if he had, like, one more conversation. Like, you know, if Uhura is like, hey, I want to talk to you about how old you're getting and how you should go back to being a starship commander.
Maybe they should have got them all together at once and they come to him. Yeah. Captain, you are getting really old.
It's an intervention. You need to girdle up and, I do think that was a really cool, and they don't do this in a lot of, I mean, I guess Marvel is doing it now, but, like, a lot of the Star Trek movies kind of, the 2, 3, 4 especially, is a nice little trilogy because, you know, Star Trek 3, they all become kind of renegades and they literally steal a starship to go out and find Spock. And they're outlaws and fugitives, and then they go save the whales, and then they come back to Earth with that little feather in their hat. But, you know, the end of that movie, Kirk gets court-martialed and busted back down to captain.
Oh, no.
Which is, it's definitely one of those situations where everybody knew that was actually a sly promotion.
Yeah.
But they finally got him back because you're right. You know, once you put Kirk in the admiral's seat, what the hell? What can you do? Like, that's a...
Right.
It's not no longer Star Trek. It's more like Star Trek administration, you know, or Star Trek budget meetings.
You know, I kind of feel like you could do an interesting one with Jean-Luc Picard in the Admiralty. I think that actually could be interesting because he's more of a thinking,
especially if it's
man's
like
captain.
A House of Cards kind of a political thriller where he's like having to outthink his opponents, and he's like treating with the Romulan ambassadors. And
yeah,
they're always trying to fuck him over. And
I think you could do it, but Kirk would just double fist smash him.
Yeah,
all.
He would. You can't
be
do
done
that.
With it.
You can't do that.
What about? So let's go back to the Kobayashi Maru real quick.
Okay,
because I wanted to talk about these. First of all, We talked about how seriously shitty of an intro this might be in a Star Trek movie if you aren't sure if they're coming back. Mm-hmm. But through the course of the movie, we hear about Kirk's trials in the Kobayashi Maru, right? Mm. And how he beat it. He essentially reprogrammed the test to where it was winnable. He cheated, as his son says. And Kirk says that they passed him for that, you know? I mean, this is a famous story now. It's in the reboot, whatever.
It's getting to point that it's almost like the death of, you know, Martha and who's the Bruce Wayne's dad, Jonathan Wayne?
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, they reenact it and have shown it so many times that yeah. It's like, okay.
So they say, okay, he cheated and he got passed for that. Yeah. Now, he clearly didn't learn the lesson that test was trying to teach him, and yet they passed him anyway for unconventional thinking.
But he did fail it twice, so he uh-huh.
But he still says he doesn't believe in the no-win scenario.
And that's kind of dumb. Like, I don't care if you don't believe in the no-win scenario believes in you.
Right.
It's like, you know, one of the elders used to say, it's like, Satan doesn't care if you believe in him, he believes in you. Like, there are no wins. I'm sorry, there are. There are no win situations, especially, again, when you're out in the cold fucking vacuum of space.
Right. But I don't know. Do you pass a student who cheats a test in a novel way? Like,
how do you not pass James T. Kirk?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like the test is designed to teach a certain lesson, and if they don't learn the lesson, they fail.
I could see them arguing, well, he did learn. He was forced to confront defeat, and then he came back and beat it because he's – and I don't know. Like, that's –
Then why didn't they pass him the first two times?
Well, I don't
– If he learned
– I don't think that's your final – that's not the final Starfleet exam, I don't think. That's
no, just but, one of the he, things but he you took do. The Kobayashi Maru three times, right?
Right, but you can't pass it. Like, everyone fails it. Everyone fails it.
So you take it over and over again until you pass all the other things?
That's fucking Kirk, because I don't know why.
Did he
like,
request it? Was he like, I want to do it again?
Yeah, I do. I think, and the professor probably is like, look, this is designed to be an unwinnable exercise. And Kirk's like, challenge accepted. And then he comes back. He's like, look, I got it this time, buddy. And then he cheats and wins. And then it's like, aha, here's your commendation for. But again, he already went through the psychological process of losing, which I think is what's important to Starfleet. Okay. I don't know. I'm just making shit up, honestly. Yeah. I mean, I don't have Starfleet regulations in front of me.
Yeah, and I forget how it goes in the reboots, but
reboots, there's a lot of apple eating. I know there's a lot of apple eating in the Kobayashi Maru simulator.
There's some apple eating here. Yeah.
Was he eating an apple?
He ate an apple when he was when he was in the Genesis cave.
Yeah.
And he's telling him like, I don't believe in the no wins.
So that's a really clever callback then, having him chomping an apple when he actually beats it.
I guess so. I guess so. I didn't realize it either. Well, let me ask you this. What does Romulan ale taste like?
I have that in my notes. Like, what is Romulan ale stronger than like Everclear?
It definitely has a distinct flavor.
Yeah, or maybe it is even like a different fucking chemical property to it.
Okay.
Like
it's not one of the five flavor profiles we understand on
Earth. I'm just saying that, like, you know, it might not be like ethyl alcohol. Like, what if it's got a little bit of, like, you know, THC or psilocybin quality to it? Like,
so he's high this whole movie. He takes a shot of Romulan ale, and then boom, he's off to the moon.
Yeah, actually, the Genesis simulation had no computer graphics in it. It was actually just like, you know, a dry spreadsheet statistical
that
analysis.
That explains the planet creation at the end.
Yeah, none of this actually happened.
Yeah.
But no, I that's the only thing I think of, because like, you can only make so strong an alcohol. So I'm wondering if there's some kind of alien, you know, alkaline property to this that does a little bit of extra woo woo to you, because that face he made was not it was the face of a man who was touching the face of God, I guess.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, are we to the point in the podcast where we just start propounding questions to each other?
Yeah.
What is the fascination with wooden ships?
Oh, in like Kirk's quarters, his office?
I mean, it makes more sense now that I've read about, you know, Nicholas Meyer and him wanting to intentionally make this more naval. But they've kept that going. It's just weird because, like, why would they stop? And I guess maybe it makes sense if, like, you were only going to have all the Enterprises that have ever been in human history. So you go back to, like, the old, wooden ship, and then you got the aircraft carrier, and then you got the NCC 1701 and 1701A. But, like, really, like, why Why would you stop there? Why wouldn't you have like a Viking ship or something? Why wouldn't it, if you want to go back to truly ancient mariners, if you feel akin to those guys, why wouldn't you go back and have something other than like European square rigged sailing ships?
I don't know. It seems to be a fascination of all the captains too, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I understand that you're piloting a essentially what is a ship, a seafaring ship in space, but I mean, Picard's got that bug.
Mm-hmm.
Sisko was the only one who avoided it. He really did the baseball thing.
Yeah.
He went heavy into Earth pastimes.
But we've talked about that before, where it's kind of always slightly odd that classical music still means the same thing it does today. Like, mm-hmm. when you'd think that there would be some Elvis. And I know they subvert that a little bit in, like, First Contact and in the Star Trek reboots, but there is, like, weird... like they go back a couple hundred years to like the Enlightenment period, and like that's like universally good, and you know, mm-hmm. like there's nothing from 20 or 21st century a human culture that you would want to experience.
Yeah, I guess this whole era is going to be just a blank spot in history, you know. It's going to be just a forgotten age. I don't know why.
Like, no Frank Sinatra?
The most,
like, I'm not saying they're going to be listening to fucking Metallica and, you know, Megadeth, but, like, no Frank Sinatra?
I guess not. Yeah.
Kind of crazy.
How about this?
Well,
the uniforms. Let's talk about the uniforms. How do you think they stack up against some of the other uniforms?
I really like this era of uniform.
There's a lot of corrugation. Like, so much corrugation. Their turtlenecks
that neck
are corrugated.
Looks uncomfortable.
It does.
And
it almost looks like, have you seen the bubble wrap that wraps around like liquor bottles?
Oh, yeah.
That those are shipped in? It looks like they're wearing one of those.
I also don't understand how the double-breasted thing works. Like when they drop a flap and let like their chest flap open, is that because they're too hot? But it's actually not exposing any of their skin. It's just like,
right.
You know, I don't get it. Like, that just looks, it makes them look sloppy. It doesn't make them look cooler. Like, if they fully open the thing to where it just hung open, then, like, okay, I get it. But
I have a jacket that's like that you can do that with, and I never understood its purpose.
Because it does. Does it make you feel cooler? Like, fractionally cooler?
Maybe slightly.
Does it make you feel cooler in, like, the Fonz sense?
Definitely.
All right. There you go. Well, then that's why James T. Kirk would do it. Yeah, I do like these because they vary. Like, it's hard to trace a line from, like, naval uniforms from, like right now, if you want to go back and look at all of the United States Navy, you can kind of draw a direct line between what they used to wear. And I know they've all gone to the weird, like, everybody wears, like, the fucking BDUs with the mil dot patterns and stuff now. Hmm. And, like, you're just daily use. But, like, if you go to the dress, you can definitely plot a course from the here to there. And I think that's also, you could go, like, Star Trek 2 through 6, same deal. Like, that looks like some kind of military uniform. But the old series uniforms are just kind of like pajamas with a velour top.
Yeah.
And the next generation that looks like kind of pajamas, velour pajamas, those don't look like any kind of uniform that I would recognize.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. There seems to be a big drastic change somewhere. Now, the First Contact uniforms, I feel, are headed more toward that tradition again.
Or even, like, the later Deep Space Nine era, where they go with, like, the more solid, like, you know, outer jacket with...
Okay, yeah.
So some same thing. And Picard even started doing some of that in the later Next Generation. Like, some of those look a little bit more military. Now, I guess because, you know, the Earth is not the lead, even though it's the capital of the Federation, like, the you'd think that a lot of the Federation aesthetic would come from, like, Vulcan and some of the other allies. So maybe the pajama stuff is more like Vulcan influence. Those are actually, if you look at, you know, 17th century Vulcan uniforms, you can trace a clear line from where there to, and then Earth is like, you know what, fucked pajamas. You know, every 10 years they take turns. Like, it's back to, you know, human traditions, and they go back to that stuff. But otherwise, I do think these are one of the cooler uniforms, though.
I do too. What about the coats that they wear?
That's, like, I was like, man, though, I think those away coats they wear are fucking badass. Like, I almost wish I could get away with wearing those on the street.
Yeah, not on the street. I think you'd be laughed at.
I think, but I first.
I mean, if you
don't
care,
don't really
sure.
Care.
Yeah, you could definitely get away with it.
They look effective too. Like that looks like a pretty good all-weather jacket.
Yeah, I think so.
And of course, as you pointed out, Kirk would definitely pop his collar.
For sure. He's the only one.
Savick and McCoy are, you know, they got their collars laid down like they're supposed to, but he's got it like he's, you know, like Cobra Commander's winter gear.
Yeah.
Winter line of fashion.
And then the doctor at the end, she's got her collar popped.
I think that's
like
because
Kirk.
She's wearing Kirk's coat. That's his letter jacket.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Is his permanently popped? Did he get like rods installed into the collar?
He's just never laid it down. Like the collar must be popped. Yeah.
All right.
Did you think that Chekhov should have soft pedaled his disdain for Khan just a little bit when they first met him?
Yeah.
Like right off the bat, going you condemned vile blood sucking criminal. Like wouldn't you be like, oh my god, Khan, so nice to see you. What the hell? Did you guys switch planets?
How'd you survive?
Well, we left you out of paradise. What's going on? Like, but no, he's just right away like. Going at him hammer and tong, and that's why you get an eel in your ear, Pavel.
Yeah, I don't remember what his feelings on Khan were in the original series, but
on those eels killing like half of Khan's crew?
Why? Well, I mean, you're sleeping, some eel babies crawl in your ear.
But it'd be one thing if it was pain-free, them wriggling your ear, but apparently that's incredibly painful. Like, the eel's body is half exposed while you're screaming, so I think you just wake up and claw at your ear and pull it and then just crush that thing.
Maybe.
You know, like, vampire bats get by because they creep up on you and they're like, there's some kind of anesthetic quality to their saliva. Is it deadens? Because, like, if you could fucking feel them biting you, you'd be like, what the fuck? And you'd kill them.
Sure.
Like, I don't know. It's like either their entry to your cerebral cortex is pain-free or else they go extinct because their whole life cycle ecosystem is stupid and crazy.
The other thing about that is they never acknowledge the fact that this thing goes in through his eardrum, right? Like, his whole ear canal is ruined.
Yeah.
And they never acknowledge the fact that he now can't hear. It's canon. He can't hear out of that side of his ears.
Yeah. Especially if the eel goes in his right ear, comes out his left, and just double fucks him.
Do they ever, like, do a joke where Chekhov can't really hear very well?
I don't think so. He screams a lot.
In future movies?
He can't say he can't enunciate V, any kind of V sound.
Yeah, it's a real bad Russian accent.
Yeah.
It's not great.
What are you going to do? If you asked me to do a Russian accent, it wouldn't be any better. It'd probably be a good deal worse.
Yeah.
I also get a kick out of the fact that Khan's eugenics war culminated in 1996.
Yep.
And then now, like, it's starting to get to the point where, like, all this stuff, like, we've so, like, you know, it's 2001, 2010, whatever year the Terminator took place, like, all that shit has just passed us by. Like, I don't know, like, it's hard to judge because in the 60s we went to the moon. Mm-hmm. So maybe Roddenberry's like, okay, 96 we'll have some starships going. He didn't see that everything would just slam to a fucking stop.
Right.
But like, seriously, if you're setting something in the near future where it's involving space travel, you got to kick it more than 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're smart enough now that we realize that.
I mean, when I hear about, like, you know, SpaceX and stuff wanting to do these Mars colonization missions in the next X amount of years, I'm like, okay, take the number they're saying and multiply it by at least five. Mm-hmm. At least five. Because that's what it's going to take. I mean, we're nowhere near Star Trek technology.
Oh, no.
Not even close.
It's actually starting to become a little bit of a bummer that it's kind of a done deal that Star Trek technology is never going to be viable.
Is it?
I mean, the more I read, it seems like you're never going to be able to exceed the speed of light.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And you're never going to be able to transport matter over any kind of real meaningful distances. Mm-hmm. And you're never going to have faster than light communication. So,
I don't know.
Star Trek style culture. Now,
understand it today, you know? It could change. Yeah. Could always change.
Yeah, I guess. It's just, like I said, the more we learn, it seems like some of these limits are harder than. It's not like the sound barrier, for example. It seems like there's more like fundamental laws of physics will not allow this stuff to happen. Again, not a theoretical physicist, maybe I'm wrong, but
yeah.
That's not to say that you can't have other cool space opera type stuff that doesn't involve faster than light travel. Like, there's other equally cool, like generational starship kind of things that I think they're starting to play with. Like, that was the whole conceit behind Passengers, right? I haven't seen Passengers yet, but it seems like they were on board a generational starship. There's a lot of cool stories you can tell and stuff like that.
No, they actually weren't. They were on board a cryogenically frozen... they were cryogenically frozen.
Right, I shouldn't say generational starship. That's because that's a starship where everyone's alive and you just actually reproduce to keep everything going.
So you won't see the end of the journey, but your offspring will.
Yeah, and maybe their offspring. But yeah, it'll take 100 years to get there. You won't make it, but you will be fathering and mothering the crew that does. Another question. Why does everyone freak the fuck out about Savick helming the ship?
Oh, when she takes it out of space dock.
Her responsibility is to tell Sulu, who they just mentioned in the movie is an experienced helmsman who knows what he's about. Her one responsibility is to tell Sulu to go forward slowly. and Kirk and McCoy are like, oh my God, can't she fucking handle it?
Right.
You know?
Right. What? There's a moment. So I compare this to like Starship
Troopers. If she says reverse all ahead full, like Sulu would be like, Captain? I mean, he wouldn't do it, would he?
Right.
Like, is that the danger? Like, he just is, they've conditioned helmsmen in the future to obey every command?
Okay, Sulu, go forward, quarter, impulse, speed, straight ahead.
Yeah, Kirstie Alley.
Now take a righteous right turn, Sulu. Are you sure about
launch
that, Captain?
Full spread of photon torpedoes. if Kirstie Alley is sitting in that seat, I can see, but she's just relaying commands to the guy who knows what he's doing.
And that's why the one in Starship Troopers works, right? Because the experienced commander is giving instructions to the helmsman, who I think is Daniel Richards. Is that her name?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In that movie. It works because she's inexperienced and you're not sure she can actually even do
Denise
it.
Denise Richards, isn't
Denise
it?
Richards, yeah.
Right, right. Or like in Galaxy Quest where the helmsman has no idea what he's doing and he's just scraping that. Yeah, like that works either way. But you just can't have a person essentially backseat driving.
Right.
That's not the danger. That's not the danger.
The danger is the helmsman not knowing what the fuck.
Settle down, Kirk. I know it's got your pulse going that a woman's helming a starship.
Right.
That's also funny that like, interesting that like 200 years in the future, we'd still have a lot of the same... You know, is it unusual to have a female commanding a starship?
Oh, I don't know.
Have we ever seen
a female commander? Was there like some kind of reaction that they gave to her being in the seat?
The fact that they're freaking the fuck out. I'm just saying it felt like a dated 80s, oh my God, woman driver joke that they put into the 24th century.
I just knew she was a trainee. She was a cadet. And
yeah,
so
yeah,
it was
that
like,
too.
And you know, she had never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it doesn't seem particularly complex.
Mm-hmm. Also, man, do they not feel like the audience is going to get anything to pick down because I thought when Kirk and Spock are having that quote-unquote encoded message that...
Oh, right.
The way they play that is so artificial that it makes Khan seem stupid.
With his superior intellect, yeah.
Yeah. Like
I'm laughing at the spirit intellect.
Yes,
I am
too.
Like,
I'm laughing at the spirit. Your uncooked chicken breast chest and your superior intellect can go fuck itself, Khan. Come at me in the nebula.
Yep.
I did like Kirk's Mac talk, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. I mean, he really gets inside the head of Khan here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he baits him into the nebula. He baits him to play the game on his terms.
Yeah.
He kind of cheats the system in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is almost a Kobayashi Maru here.
It's just crazy how, like, easily manipulated some thin-skinned moron is when you give him command of something. Kind of frightening.
Let's talk about psychology for a quick second.
All right.
I don't think McCoy's insults are as effective as he wants them to be. Because I think when you call Spock a green-blooded, inhuman, whatever he was going to call him, he's like, those are facts.
Right.
I do, in fact, have green blood. I am, in fact, inhuman. Like,
well,
I think Spock needs to get deeper into the psychology of Spock, or McCoy needs to get deeper in the psychology of Spock to really get under his skin.
What's funny, because they should be effective, and they're also kind of horrifying, because in the Star Trek canon, it's kind of established that... You know, that's something that Spock feels self-conscious about, the fact his dual nature, and he's torn between two, and he's got these emotions and this drives that he doesn't quite feel, he can't fully suppress, and he feels like he's a failure as a Vulcan, and he feels like he's a repressed and half-lived human, and that's kind of like the thing that makes him tick. Mm-hmm. So, like, McCoy calling him constantly, essentially slightly high-minded versions of half-breed. That's not cool, man.
Yeah, but
McCoy's a fucking racist.
Spock aspires to be the inhuman green-blooded Vulcan, right? Like right. That's his highest aspiration,
right?
So calling him that, I think, is just pretty flattering.
But I'm just saying, like, yeah,
if
I know
you were to call him, like, yeah, half breed or
Spock doesn't rise to debate. It's just still kind of crazy that McCoy is slinging that kind of just purely That's racial true. Bile towards yeah. this guy.
And yet McCoy
never
has
deserves it.
Maybe one of the best jokes in the movie when Kirk and the other Vulcan, Kirstie Alley,
yeah.
Are in the elevator and they stop the elevator and the doors open and Kirk's like, "Who's been holding up the damn elevator?"
McCoy, yeah.
McCoy. Jesus.
Because Kirstie Alley like pauses the elevator to talk to I thought like for a brief second, like is there gonna be like some kind of weird she's got an infatuation with him angle?
Oh boy.
Because they kind of played it like he's like, "Oh, you changed your hair," and "Oh, I'm wearing my off-duty, you know, come hither robe," and I'm pulling the emergency plug.
That's
on
just
the
Kirk
elevator.
Testing the waters.
Yeah.
She wasn't having any of it, but Kirk's always going to try.
Well, no, she's the one that initiated it all, but it never came. I think she was just genuinely curious about this Kobayashi Maru shit.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the mixed metaphors in here? Scotty says he's bypassed the reactor like a Christmas tree. What the fuck does that mean?
And then Spock immediately chimes in with sauce for the goose.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what that means either.
I don't either. I don't. I think like sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, which you're like, is usually kind of what you would say to when someone's like if you did something to me unfair and I did it immediately right back to you and you complained, I'd be like, "Well, sauce for the goose." It's not quite fitting, and maybe that's because he's a Vulcan. He doesn't quite understand human metaphor, but it's not quite the exact same thing they're doing the con.
Right. It was very confusing to me. But so I found out something interesting on Wikipedia about A Tale of Two Cities.
Is it all about sauces for goose?
It is. It's about how to goose a sauce or sauce a goose, one or the other.
Uh-huh.
No, actually, in the book, Dickens uses a lot of literal English translations of French idioms,
mm-hmm.
and it was very confusing to the people reading it at the time that he wrote it.
Right.
And so I think that's actually really smart dialogue based on that sort of thing from the book.
Well, there's a couple other smart things, because I remember seeing when they're kind of like Chekhov is feasting his eyes all about and looking all over Khan's personal quarters. There's prominently a checkerboard set up with actually checker pieces. And I'm thinking, What the fuck? Wouldn't Khan at least play chess?
Right.
Like really super intelligent guys are just playing endless games of checkers. That's like one of the most like if you and I played checkers for an hour, we would get a stalemate like 90% of the time. It's pretty much an easy to solve game. But then at the end, they kind of also say, like, to expose his weakness as a naval commander, that he's not had enough experience to think in three-dimensional terms.
Right.
And I wonder if he was trying to suggest very subtly that, like, Khan plays checkers and Kirk plays chess.
I think so, yeah. Which is surprising given his vast intellect, his artificial intellect. I don't know. I mean, it's like, you know, I used to really enjoy playing Risk a lot.
Right.
But that's not a very advanced strategy game.
No, it'd be hard to go back to playing Risk at this point.
Right. So if I was playing Risk and Kirk was playing, you know, even Axis and Allies is a pretty bad example, but like War Machine or something, then we're talking about it two entirely different things.
Well, in this universe, literally a thing called four-dimensional chess exists. So, like, he could just be playing three-dimensional chess, and you could still make the same, like,
I think
know,
they call
analogy.
It three-dimensional chess.
Don't they?
The actual game. But you're right. Like, a three-dimensional game being played is automatically a four-dimensional game.
Right.
Because time is involved.
That's true.
And if
That's
time
true.
Isn't involved, it's not much of a game at
no,
all.
No, it's just a static snapshot in time.
Right.
So the final scene where, well, not the final scene, but the climax of the third act where Spock is sticking his hands in the reactor and fixing it with his oven mitts on.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is he actually doing? Is he sticking his hands into a matter-antimatter reactor? Like, what the hell? Is he, like, changing spark plugs? Is he real? I wish they'd told me what the hell he was doing, because it just looks like he's sticking his hands into an out-of-control, elemental universal furnace.
Right.
And how do you fix that?
I don't know. I don't know what he does.
He's aligning the lithium crystals, and he has to yank him out of the matrix, and like he's just getting bathed in radiation and shit, but like, you
know. At least show him swap apart, right?
Does he?
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, he just.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh,
like,
yeah, there you
go. At least show him do that.
Right. Like, there's like a. He pulls out a dark, burnt out dilithium crystal, and he pulls a fresh one out. But he just literally puts on the oven mitts and sticks his face down there for a couple seconds.
Yeah, and then puts the cap back on.
And then all the things go back to nominal, and they take off. No problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of that syndrome that they have of not explaining anything or hand waving it away, which was fine back then.
Yeah. And like I said, this is the finest Star Trek ever made, in my opinion. Second best on runner up for you. So
real close though.
And the other thing is, if you're just watching this movie for entertainment value, it really works. I tend to watch these things with like my fanboy hat on because I enjoy that. Like one of my there used to be the Starlog. Every year they'd have a volume to come out with like the best of Starlog, where it'd have like all these different essays from the previous year. And my favorites were always the ones that would eviscerate like whatever the latest Star Trek is from a very technical and like canon and you know, just like a new kind of thing. So I always enjoyed those good natured like ass kickings that you would give something that you love, and
sure,
only someone that loves it that much could kick its ass that hard.
Right You have to be knowledgeable about it.
Yeah,
you have to have dedicated a lot of your life
to give
that
a
thing.
Shit about the science and the technology and the characters to get the inconsistencies, but that's the thing. Like, I don't think any of the characters here just fucking work, and
they do.
This is the last time we get like classic Spock for a good long while, like kind of arguably till you get to Star Trek VI.
Right.
Because he's non-existent in Star Trek 3. He's like got some kind of screw loose in Star Trek 4. Star Trek 5, I've only seen once.
That's a real bad
movie.
We
should sit down and watch that and like do a live watch on it, because I remember what does God need a starship?
Yep.
I know Uhura's fan dance. And there's this really funny part where Scotty says, "I know the starship like the back of my hand," and he smacks his head on a girder and knocks himself out.
Is that the one where they're stranded in the mining colony or whatever?
No, that's Star Trek VI.
That's VI, okay.
Five is where they're going to the center of the universe, and they got Spock's brother's half-brother Cybok, who's some space hippie.
Spock's half-brother Cybok.
And they're going to go meet God.
Oh, my God.
And it turns out who's some kind of vaguely criminal entity that's trying to get off the planet.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
That's a real.
Literally, all I remember from that movie is, "What does God need with a starship?"
It's got to be. I mean, I remember it even as a teenager thinking, "This is a piece of shit."
Yeah.
This is a real piece of shit letdown of a Star Trek movie.
I guess one of the minor complaints I have with this movie is that every other line seems to be someone prompting someone else for their line. Like, Kirstie Alley, I can't even count the number of times she. In a completely silent scene, in a scene where she should be either walking away or asking a question, she turns as if she's going to say something.
Yeah.
And she says, "Admiral?"
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then Kirk goes off on some, like...
Right.
Just really, I don't know, introspective sort of soliloquy. And it's like she was just there to prompt him for his line.
She's begging the dialogue.
Yes. And I really got annoyed by that.
I have to say that
I think it's a flaw in the actual dialogue.
It breaks my heart that Kirstie Alley blew up in terms of her fame in between this and the next movie, because they keep Savick around, and then they also had the Vulcan woman in Star Trek VI, who turns out to be the traitor. That'd have been a really cool arc for her character to take. Like, that's making a character out of whole cloth, and Kirstie Alley did she's a pretty intelligent actor, I think, and she did enough with that to make her interesting, even though we knew next to nothing about her, and they cut out some of the most interesting backstory. But it'd be cool to introduce a fresh character like that that gives you a little bit of, you know, new insight into Spock's character, and she could kind of like grow up and be interesting in her own right.
Yeah.
And keep a little bit of youth and vitality into the cast. It's too bad that, you know, she had better things to do, because Savick got recast in 3 with a much less interesting actor, and then got written out, and then they had some name. I can't even remember the Vulcan's name, the Sabotage one.
How big were these movies back in the day? In their day?
Were they blockbusters?
They were.
Like, Star Trek 2 made $78 million, which doesn't sound like a lot, but yeah. I guess it was a shit ton of money back in the day.
That's weird. I don't know why she wouldn't want to reprise her role.
Well, I don't know, because she hit it big in Cheers, and she had that. That's a big commitment, and...
Yeah, I guess so. She was big on TV then. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of... You know, as far as science fiction goes, this series, Star Trek as a whole, mm-hmm. is definitely one of the more formative ones for me. It, mm-hmm. Easily, like, most formative, tied kind of with Star Wars. You know, Battlestar Galactica was kind of before and after my era of formative sci-fi years.
Not
a lot of other stuff on.
I have a hard time saying which one I like best. I mean, I think Star Wars was like my first love. Like, I was like I loved that as a little boy. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek, I came in a little bit later in life. Not much. Like, I was in fifth, sixth grade when I started getting really into Star Trek. But,
well, we've talked about this. We did a Blue Yonder on Star Trek versus Star Wars, right?
Well,
back in the day. And we talked about how we said, okay, which would you rather have happen? Mm-hmm. Eliminate all of your knowledge of Star Trek or Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you and I certainly both picked Star Trek because, as we saw it, it is more of a series for adults, series who can people who can understand the messages of the show. Whereas Star Wars is a fun, fantastical adventure movie.
Yeah.
Which is awesome in its own right, and I love it. But, you know, as an adult, I think Star Trek is more affecting for me.
Yeah, now, the one thing, as I continue to get older, I continue to see that Star Trek kind of gets dated. Because, like, some of the, like, if you go back, especially the old series, mm-hmm. and you've got, like, where the bombshell is that Kirk is kissing Uhura, mm-hmm. you know, that was obviously really controversial and progressive in his day. It's, like, kind of ho-hum. And then you go back to Next Generation, I'm thinking that random plot where Riker visits the planet of androgyny and he falls in love with of one of the creatures that then they're not allowed to be male or female, so it's like this commentary and forbidden homosexual relationships, and that's kind of like passe. And
sure,
so it's like that's the thing. It's like, yes, it is more interesting and it has more of a message and has more of adult themes, but also those themes constantly get, you know, ground into historical grist, so it's more kind of almost unintentional comedy or irrelevant by the time. So I don't know, but
yeah.
And the other side of the argument is there's a hell of a lot more Star Trek to enjoy.
That's true, yeah.
But I guess we didn't see it coming that they'd continue to make Star Trek or Star Wars. Like, they're like that. That's just like the Disney assembly line is full force, and they're going to crank out one a year. So it'd be interesting in 10 years if we'd revisit that topic if our answer would stay the same.
Right, and you got Clone Wars and all kinds of stuff.
And also, like, you got
the novels. And
Star Trek's also very uneven. Like, if you're talking about the old series, Next Generation, and Deep Space Nine, half of that is straight-up garbage.
You can't tell me that Star Wars isn't also entirely uneven.
Well,
half of Star Wars is straight-up garbage.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate. And becoming less true.
Sure, yeah.
But that's almost like that's... Yeah, yeah. You got me there. You got me there, Jim.
All right.
The topic's dead, Jim.
Yep, I think we killed it.
Anything else you want to say about Star Trek 2, Wrath of Khan?
Nah. I do thoroughly enjoy this movie every time I watch it, though.
All right, Josh. Speaking of thoroughly enjoyed, I've thoroughly enjoyed the experience of your little podcasting trilogy, if not the experience of watching all of them. I did enjoy the podcast we made, and it's a lot of fun watching Star Trek here in the office with my buddy. Thanks for commissioning that. Again, special thanks to Josh Wilson and Anubis21 on the forums. And we will be back with another commission podcast before you know it, and hopefully get the shop fixed here real soon.
Yeah.
That's been longer than I would like, but I've been super busy with moving and stuff, and that continues to be the case. So I'm working on getting it back so we can start taking commissions again. But the good news is, / bad news is, we also had a huge backlog, so you're not really losing any ground. So we'll let you know when you get it going again. So again, thanks. We'll be back with another commission podcast real soon, and we'll see you then.